This is Boston Public Radio. I'm Kara Miller. My guest, Lisa Bloom, is the author of Swagger. And here's how she starts the introduction to her book. At this very moment, through no fault of their own, our boys are caught in the vortex of four powerful, insidious, and often invisible forces that conspire to rob them of their future. Lisa Bloom is a civil rights attorney, and her latest book is Swagger, 10 Urgent Rules for Raising Boys in an Age of Failing Schools, Mass Joblessness, and Thug Culture. Lisa Bloom, thanks for being here.
Thank you so much for having me.
So let's start by talking about one of those forces, which is thug culture. And I thought, you know, you talk about all different sort of media influences, which I want to get into. But I think one of the questions that people might have is, okay, well, haven't there always been violent comic books? Haven't there always been gangster movies? You know, things that we were really worried that would affect kids growing up. How is today any different?
You know, I thought the same thing when I set out to do the research for this book, and so much of what I discovered surprised me. And in the chapter about thug culture in particular, I was shocked at how much media that kids consume has changed in a generation. It's true that parents have always worried about the music their kids listen to. Maybe there was a little sexual innuendo. Maybe the beat was too loud and insistent. But what kids are consuming today is radically different from just a generation ago. Two-thirds of the most popular top-selling rap and hip-hop music, for example, celebrates violence, especially gun violence, rape, including rape of little girls, illegal drug use, and murdering gay men. I mean, those are some really shocking numbers. Boys' video games, which are extremely popular with boys as young as 2 or 3 years old, rarely have a problem that can't be solved with very gory, bloody violence. And there's no question that all of this violence has a profound effect on our boys. The United States has far higher rates of violence amongst our boys than any other first world country, especially gun violence. What I'm advocating in the book is certainly not censorship, but rather parents becoming aware of what their kids are watching and listening to, especially what they're listening to, because boys, like all kids, tend to listen to music with their earbuds in or in their rooms with the doors closed. And when parents read some of the lyrics from these top songs, an Eminem song that celebrates raping a little girl in Central Park, for example, they're going to be shocked. I put the lyrics in the book. I'm sure you don't want me to.
No, I did read some of them. They are, for somebody right? who doesn't listen to this stuff, they are pretty shocking.
Yeah. And so, but parents, you know what? We need to know. We need to know what values are being transmitted to our boys so that we can stand up for our own values. And I have scripts in the book on how to have these conversations with your kid, because the good news is that when our kids are asked, who's your number one role model, it's not athletes or celebrities or rappers. It's always mom and dad. And so we have tremendous moral force in our home. Even if we think our kids are, you know, glowering at us under their hoodies, they are listening. And so we have to have the knowledge of what the media is that they're consuming so that we can have the conversations with them.
You know, let me delve a little deeper into this question of how much violence gets from screens, which, as you say in the book, kids on average spend more than 7 hours a day in front of some kind of screen. How do we know whether violence that we see on screens translates into real behavior? I mean, I know you said that America has very high levels of gun violence, but we see video games, they're very popular in Korea, they're very popular all around the world. So is there some difference between the people who are able to play video games and compartmentalize that as, well, that's just a game, and the people who are not able to and let it sort of spill over into their lives?
Well, there are certainly some kids who absorb a lot of violent culture and turn out fine. But it's certainly also well known that it's just unhealthy for kids to be consuming this much. Our kids in America consume a lot more violent media than kids in South Korea or other countries. The American Academy of Pediatrics has issued warning after warning about this. You know, there are tons of social science studies. I got 500 footnotes in my book that well document the impact of media on kids. In fact, the American Academy of Pediatrics says children under 2 should have no media, no screens at all. If people don't think media has an impact on children, why does Coca-Cola spend hundreds of millions of dollars a year advertising? Are they just throwing their money out the window? I mean, corporate America spends huge amounts of advertising because they know that media has a profound effect not only on adults, but on kids as well, on all of us.
Yeah, and you actually have a very interesting quote from former Disney CEO Michael Eisner, who many of us know, you know, when we were growing up, he would introduce Disney's Sunday Showcase on TV. And he talks about what media's objective is. And here's the quote that you have. "We have no obligation to make history. We have no obligation to make art. We have no obligation to make a statement. To make money is our only objective." It seemed kind of crass, but I guess if you're a publicly traded company, that's your objective.
Sure. And, you know, one of the things I talk about in the book is explaining to your children what media is. Media, with the exception of public radio and a few others, for the most part is a capitalist enterprise in America. And their mission is to make money for their shareholders. I mean, Michael Eisner was very straightforward about that, as many other CEOs have been as well. They make money by getting eyeballs in front of screens and selling advertising. And increasingly, they make money by implanting product placement into their shows. Product placement is very confusing for children. Children over the age of, you know, maybe 9 or so understand that a commercial is a commercial. But they don't understand that the Coke cups on American Idol, for example, that the judges are holding are, of course, bought and paid for. That all the mentions of iTunes and Ford and everything else, those are all bought and paid for. And it's a very insidious kind of advertising for children. So unlike at home, where parents presumably have their children's best interests at heart, or school, where teachers do, advertising does not have children's best interests at heart. Television doesn't. Video games don't. They're trying to sell. That is their mission in life. And kids need to understand that.
One of your prescriptions, which seems, I have to say, kind of hard to execute, is to fill your home with reading. And you talk, the reading part may not be as hard, but you talk, give an example of your nephews who love to read, and they have no TVs at home. You know, your relatives got rid of the TVs when the kids were very young. So,
yes.
I mean, is that possible for most people to actually sort of take TV out of their lives?
Well, what I try to do in the book is give real answers to questions that parents have. And instead of giving parents the answers that we might want to hear, for example, look, I have two kids, 20 and 22. We certainly had TVs in the home and all the screens and devices. When I reflect back on it, there's no question that I let my kids spend too much time on the screens, knowing what I know now, knowing the research that I did for the book, how damaging screens are in general to children's brain development. And, you know, I've had a lifelong rivalry with my younger brother about many things, including parenting. His method was, at the birth of his first son, to get rid of television entirely from their home. And to them, it was a radical act, especially because he's a great sports fan and he misses out watching sports. Computer time is extremely limited. They can play a few video games on the computer once in a while, but very, very rarely. Well, cut to today, 14 years later, and both of his boys are 2 years ahead in reading. They have the highest levels of intellectual curiosity of any boys that I interviewed, and I interviewed many boys all over the country for my book. You know, they are a teacher's dream. They are a parent's dream. And there's no question that that was the better way in terms of brain development for children. Most of the boys I interviewed for the book said they hate reading, that reading is for girls. One boy said, "I'd rather be burned at the stake than read a book," you know, with wonderful boyish exuberance.
Right.
But that's the real epidemic that's sweeping our country today, is boys' dislike of reading. And that's the root problem for many of them in school, because reading is important in almost all subjects.
Interestingly, I thought one of the things that you said that comes from screens and from music that we may not think of was, you said, the sort of lost value of humility. And you talk about self-doubt being the new sin for males. Now, I have to say, a lot of people think that really their jobs as parents is to instill in their children a sense of self-confidence and self-worth. You know, why would you want people to be humble? Why do you see humility as this lost virtue?
Well, I call the book Swagger, not because it's a book about how to swagger, but because swagger is a word I heard over and over from boys all over the country, and almost no parents are aware of it. Swagger was the most popular song lyric in the last decade across all genres, rap, hip-hop. Even the Jonas Brothers are singing about swagger. And what began as kind of a fun attitude of puffing out your chest and strutting a little bit, for many boys has really crossed the line into arrogance. And, for example, our kids are 25th in the world out of 30 countries in math, but in one area they're number one, confidence, and that's especially true for our boys. And I go all the way back to the Bible, which has so many bromides about humility. Pride goes before a fall. With humility comes wisdom. Humility is really a lost value. But the social science of today really bears out that children who are arrogant, who are overconfident, suffer in school, are emotionally less healthy, are more likely to fight, to drink, to do illegal drugs. And so bringing that attitude down a notch is critical to your son's future. Now, I too, like many parents, you know, told my children they were, you know, the most fabulous creatures on earth because they got up in the morning and brush their teeth after I begged and bribed them three times, right? Turns out that is not healthy. That is not good parenting in spite of what we all think. Instead, what we should be doing is praising very specific effort. You spent an extra hour on your homework last night and you brought your grade up from a C to a B. I'm very proud of you. You stuck with the team even after the first week you wanted to quit. Good for you. If we praise effort, our children are more likely to dig in, work harder, persevere, and ultimately do better. Because after all, if he's already all that, why does he have to struggle in school? Why does he have to try?
Yeah, I'm talking to Lisa Bloom, the author of Swagger, 10 Urgent Rules for Raising Boys in an Era of Failing Schools, Mass Joblessness, and Thug Culture. And I want to get into this issue of school, which you have touched on. We do clearly have an imbalance when it comes to, for example, girls graduating from college and boys graduating from college. Girls are about 57% of college graduates. Boys are 43%. I remember several years ago, the head of Kenyon College admissions office wrote a well-known article in the New York Times about how at Kenyon College, they honestly had to turn down more girls, and they could make more allowances in terms of the quality of the boys that they were accepting because, frankly, they were unwilling to have a school that was 60% women and 40% men, and that's maybe what they would have needed to do if they were doing things by merit. What has happened? Why are girls more valedictorians? Are they more college graduates? What happened here?
Right. So not only are girls graduating college in greater numbers and with better grades, but if we weren't practicing affirmative action for males in college, as the Kenyon College administrator revealed and many others have revealed as well, the numbers would be even greater. So in the book, I track this all the way back to preschool at the earliest ages. As we are increasingly teaching to the test and we've cut recess and PE, boys who tend to be more kinetic and wiggly in the early years and really all through school have a very hard time, and they're labeled as bad as early as 3 or 4 years old. You couldn't sit still. You were acting out. You were throwing things. Parents get called in, and boys very early start to get the message that their kind isn't really welcome in school, that they're forced to go, and they do go, but they really don't like it. And so to rebel, they mentally check out. As girls do better in verbal skills in the early years, boys don't like losing in a competition, and they sense that they are losing. They continue to check out. Boys are also more likely to cover up their problems. You know, my opinion about why girls are doing so much better in school is in large part because girls spend more time on homework, and girls are more likely to ask for help because they have less of that swagger attitude of arrogance. Girls are more likely to just ask mom, ask an older sibling, ask a teacher or counselor for help and say, I don't get it, than boys are. And as the years go by, I mean, one of the things I discovered in the book is that if boys are not reading proficiently by the fourth grade, you can almost track them to do very poorly, probably get D's and F's in high school, drop out of high school, and have a very difficult life because there are so few jobs today for high school dropouts or even high school grads who didn't have good grades. So it's critical that parents understand and target a son's problem or a daughter's problem in the early grades so that they can correct it, you know, while there's still some chance.
Now, it's really interesting. I mean, there must have been a tipping point here because, okay, if you look at, let's say, Harvard's graduating class in 1950, right, 100% of the people were men. So it never used to be that people thought that education was inherently geared towards women or that men had some sort of problem studying and becoming doctors and lawyers and professors and whatever else. So what happened here? Did we start teaching people differently? Did boys really just start trying less or start sort of checking out more?
Well, I'll tell you a couple things. One is that kids are tested in third grade, eighth grade, and 11th grade in reading in all 50 states. And guess in how many states are girls outperforming boys in all three levels?
I don't know.
50.
Wow.
All 50.
Wow.
Okay. In 40 first world countries where girls and boys have equal access to education, girls and boys are tested for reading. And in all 40, girls are outperforming boys. So you talk about 50 years ago at Harvard University, of course, there were so many barriers to women's education. Women were simply not allowed in at many schools, or there were quotas. When my mother, Gloria Allred, some people know her, when she went to law school, there was a maximum of about 5% women that were allowed in. When those barriers are taken down, women tend to do very, very well. And in the countries in the world where there are still barriers, of course, women don't do as well. But where the barriers are down, we've just gone storming through. But I also think that the nature of education has changed. A lot of it is focused on reading, writing, and communication skills, on cooperation and mutual effort, skills that girls tend to be better at. And as I say, eliminating recess and PE has really been very tough on boys. One of the simple fixes I did for my kids, who had spielkiss when they were little kids, which is the Yiddish word for antsiness, ants in the pants, I'd take them to school a half an hour early and let them run around the playground and, you know, get some of that energy out. I mean, there are simple fixes that we can do, but a lot of people have advocating changing the classroom for boys to make it a little bit more boy-friendly. My book is for parents and what parents can do after school on weekends to get boys excited about books. I have a 12-page long reading list at the end of Swagger, for example, books boys love that we compiled talking to boys and parents all over the country, because there are a lot of great books out there that they do love, and how you can restructure your home to make it more reading-friendly. One of the most important things parents can do is to read for pleasure yourself in front of your kids. Turn off all the screens, sit down on the sofa while they're around, and openly and notoriously, as we say in the law, read a book and laugh out loud at the funny parts and read the good lines out loud and encourage your kid to sit next to you. Because kids who have parents who read for pleasure are 6 times more likely to read for pleasure themselves. And when they read for pleasure, they're going to do better in all subjects. Their literacy goes up. I mean, it's just a win-win for everyone.
We're talking about boys and the challenges they're facing and what parents can do to help them reach their potential. My guest is Lisa Bloom. Her new book is Swagger, 10 Urgent Rules for Raising Boys in an Age of Failing Schools, Mass Joblessness, and Thug Culture. And you can join the conversation at 877-301-8970. That's 877-301-8970. Parents, what are your sons going through? And teachers, what are you seeing when you look at today's boys? Fathers, does your boyhood seem easier than what your sons are going through right now? It's 877-301-8970 to join the conversation. I'm Kara Miller. We continue on Boston Public Radio. This is Boston Public Radio. I'm Kara Miller, and we're talking about boys this hour and the challenges that they face. My guest is Lisa Bloom, and her new book is Swagger, 10 Urgent Rules for Raising Boys in an Age of Failing Schools, Mass Joblessness, and Thug Culture. And we're taking your calls at 877-301-8970. And I want to bring into this discussion Richard Melvoin. He is the head of Belmont Hill School, which is dedicated to developing boys in mind, in body and spirit. Richard Melvoin, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
So, you know, you see sort of some of the same statistics that Lisa Bloom sees in terms of, as we said, you know, it used to be, of course, that the graduating class at Harvard was 100% male. Now we see a landscape in which 57% of the people who are graduating from college are women. So what has happened here? Is it our approach to boys? Is it boys' approach to school?
I think Lisa's observations are spot on in looking at how serious the issues are. They're not new. This isn't something that's come all of a sudden. You asked about a tipping point before. I think there's been a general trending over the last perhaps generation. And I think some of it, ironically, came during an important time when our society realized that we needed to serve girls and women better. As the father of two girls, as well as somebody who's been in education my whole life, I think that's been laudable. But I think when people who have developed, like Carol Gilligan's book, In a Different Voice, started to get people to think about the fact that girls have a different voice, we need also to remember that boys have a different voice, and we need to hear what that is. So when Lisa suggests that her book is for parents and how can parents help, I think one of the steps that parents need to take is to go, if they have sons, to schools and make sure that teachers are working in ways that are friendly for boys. I think too much of our education in many of our schools is, as Lisa suggested, it sets up models for good behavior, but good behavior tends to be girl behavior. Boys are different.
What does it mean to have a classroom that's friendly to boys, that's set up so that boys can succeed?
Well, our school has been, Belmont Hill is a boys' school, a school for boys, and we've joined actually with over 200 schools around the world, literally forming an international boys' schools coalition to think about best practices for boys. Lisa identified some of the ways in which boys seem to work differently. They run around, they're more physical. Boys show affection by bumping into each other. And we have to remember that that's good, healthy boy behavior so that teachers can acknowledge it and work with it. Boys tend to respond often successfully in classrooms when there is a competition involved. It could be learning vocabulary, but if it's turned into a game, boys may respond much more quickly and much more positively. Actually, we did a research project with a number of the schools, the international schools from literally around the world, in thinking about factors where teachers can be more effective. And interestingly, the most important single factor we came up with in understanding how boys can be successful in school is the relational issue. If boys believe the teachers believe in them, then they will go through walls for them. Hmm. They will work hard for them. But if they see teachers who don't care what they're doing, don't care about them, then they often turn off and turn away. And then we get into some of the frightening statistics that Lisa cited in terms of boys' dropout rates or truancy rates or disciplinary problems.
We've got a lot of people who want to join the conversation. Let me go first to Kevin in Providence, Rhode Island. Kevin, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
So what's your view of sort of this swag culture of education? What are you hearing?
Well, I just kind of wanted to take a little bit of issue with bringing swag culture in as kind of the focal point of where this attitude shift comes from, because I'm a social studies teacher here in Providence, and just historically speaking, this is more of an American attitude problem that goes back to kind of the founding of this country, where we have American exceptionalism and this concept of America as the number one nation, and we don't tend to question that very often when it comes up in all of public culture. I'm thinking also of when Bush was president, there was a country song, I don't remember who sang it, and essentially the idea was, right or wrong, this is our country, and the idea that swag culture, I almost think that it kind of scapegoats these urban youth of color who really have come up with this as almost an empowering culture as well. And the other thing I wanted to bring into the conversation was, and I'm not sure if this was addressed, was the issue of zero tolerance policies and how that also takes a disproportionate toll on children of color, specifically males of color in schools.
Kevin, let me ask you, what did you see in your boyhood in terms of this sort of swag culture?
I kind of came from a little bit of the opposite spectrum of the music scene, coming from kind of a punk childhood. And we had just kind of a very similar thing, but it was more of an empowerment of kind of coming from impoverished backgrounds, working class parents. Both of my parents came here as immigrants, and kind of punk swag, if you will, was just this concept that, you know, I don't come from ample means or resources, but I'm still worth something. I still have dignity as both a man and a human being. And to me, that's something that swag has been taken too far to some extent, but I don't think swag can be blamed for all of the arrogance in our culture. I think that's historically much more deeply rooted.
Lisa, thank you so much, Kevin, for joining us. Lisa Bloom, let me go to you on that idea that maybe swag helps build people up, and Kevin's notion that perhaps it's our discussion of America as an exceptional country that could be the problem with people lacking humility.
First, of all, I never said that our swagger culture is the root of, you know, every problem in the world for boys or for America. But and I also agree that there are many aspects of it that are positive, that are empowering, for example, especially for inner city youth. But there's no question that there's been a dramatic rise in arrogance and overconfidence amongst our boys. 50 years ago, American high school students were asked, do you think you're a very important person? Only 12% said yes. Today, that number is in the high 80%. And I agree that, frankly, they are very important people. Each and every one of our children is a very important person, but so is everyone else. And that's the message that we fail to get through to them. When they're strutting, when they're swaggering, when they're singing along with some of these vile song lyrics that I couldn't repeat on your show, but which are in the book, this is not a healthy attitude. And as I say, the education and social science data bears out that children who are overconfident tend to have a myriad of problems, especially in school, because they're afraid to ask for help. I will also say that moms in general tend to applaud me when I talk about the swagger culture because they know what I'm talking about with overconfident boys. This is something that's a real gender divide. I've done a lot of interviews about this, and I've had a lot of women come up to me and say, thank God someone is putting their finger on this problem because there are too many boys out there who have a false sense of themselves.
Richard Melvoin, head of Belmont Hill School. Go right ahead.
Thanks. This is an issue, I think, at least I don't disagree with you about boys, but I think it's one for our generation as well. There was a piece in The Atlantic within the last couple of years by Lori Gottlieb called How to Land Your Kid in Therapy. And it looks more broadly at kids who are now emerging as young adults in their 20s who are maybe getting doomed to unhappy adulthoods by having such happy childhoods or times when they're being told how wonderful they are on an ongoing basis. And
yeah.
So I think to Lisa's broader point, we've seen a societal shift in the last generation, which we need to think about and bring back more understanding of the value and the importance of humility in everyone's lives.
Have you seen that amongst students that you work with, that sort of shift from maybe more humility to less humility over time?
I'm not sure how much we see it in our students that isn't exacerbated by their parents. I think that it's a very tricky issue because as parents, we all want to support our children. But if a child doesn't make it on a team or doesn't get an A in a class, sometimes parents have to accept that that's who the child is and that's where he or she has landed.
Can I speak to the parenting point on this? Because one of the rules I have in the book for parents is to support your teacher. One of the ways that parents unwittingly promote this swagger attitude is this kind of scenario. Teacher calls the parent and the boy in and says, the boy is having a problem in school. He's misbehaving. He hasn't turned in his homework. And the parent turns to the boy and says, is this true? Well, of course it's true. The teacher just told you it's true. And that kind of a line undermines the teacher's authority. You know, many teachers complain to me that parents come in like a criminal defense attorney, you know, trying to find some loophole or technicality to explain the child's behavior instead of working with the teacher to correct the behavior. The other thing that I heard from teachers over and over again is to please let your kids get enough sleep. That so many kids come to school sleep deprived and they just can't learn. I just talked to a boy yesterday who tells me he routinely stays up till 3 a.m. on school nights. You know, his parents don't like it, but they don't rein him in. You know, so we parents have to work together with teachers and listen very carefully to what the teachers are telling us, because frankly, it's much easier for teachers just to say, your son's great, everything's fine, than to criticize because they know they may be in for a struggle if they do that. Let's not struggle against them. Let's work with them.
One interesting interview you had in the book was with the California Charter School Teacher of the Year, and you asked him what was the hardest part about teaching. And this was somebody who, interestingly, did not have a classroom to teach in.
Yeah.
And he said the hardest thing about teaching was parents.
Yes, that's right. And to the shame of my local school district that this fabulous teacher had to teach outside with kids in parkas zipped up and hats and mittens on the day that I went, a cold winter day, and competing with the traffic noise and the weather, because we didn't see fit to give him a classroom. And he has to go online on a website called donorschoose.org, which is a website set up in America so that teachers can beg for books, computers, pencils, basic classroom supplies that we're not providing them. I mean, the first chapter of my book is how we've all deprived prioritized education as a culture. We've allowed massive cuts to swing year after year after year through our school districts, cutting and cutting, class sizes growing, depriving them of basic supplies. I mean, this is really the appalling situation in America. I can guarantee you that in Finland and Korea and other countries that are routinely trouncing us on international competitions, their teachers do not have to beg strangers for books or for an extra hour in the school day. Overall, American kids go to school 1 year less by the end of the 12th grade than kids in Western Europe and Eastern Asia. So it's no surprise that they can't compete ultimately when they graduate.
Let me get in another call here. Walter, also from Providence, Rhode Island, who is the president of a parent-teacher organization of a middle school, right, Walter?
Yes, hello. Thanks for taking my call.
No problem.
Just this morning, we had orientation for our 6th grade class, and I'm trying to get more parents involved, so I shook hands with every single parent that came in there, and I welcomed them to the school. And this is a mixed population, and I have to say that people are timid. They don't look you in the eye. You can see they don't feel so welcome, and I think that transfers to their students, that they're just not feeling that they belong in education, that, you know, education is important to them as it is to me.
Interesting, interesting. Thank you so much, Walter. Richard Melvoin, let me bring that to you, that idea of an increasing separation potentially between parents and schools.
I think we need to partner with parents. As Lisa said, I believe we need to have parents have high expectations of schools and try to find a way to work in there. But it also calls for parents to respect the schools in a way that I think may have in some places been lost or at least been more limited. We need parents to support the schools when we try to offer discipline, when we try to establish standards. We want the best for the children who come to our schools. But that means sometimes there's tough love involved and there are challenges involved.
And children are very different in school than they are at home. And that's why when a teacher tells you your son is behaving a particular way, it can be difficult for a parent to understand that because he's not like that at home. Mm-hmm. But school is a completely different environment.
Richard, let me ask you, we were talking before about screens and the immense presence that they have now in children's lives, seven and a half, 8 hours a day that children often spend either playing video games or watching TV or surfing the internet or whatever. I wonder if you see the effect of that on boys that you work with at Belmont Hill.
We're very fortunate at Belmont Hill. As an independent school, it's fairly selective for admission. And so the boys and the families who come have made a significant commitment to be at the school. And part of the commitment they make is that they're going to work hard if they're going to be able to survive and thrive academically. So I don't think kids have the kind of time that you suggest. I think also a school, if it can offer a comprehensive program which gets boys there not for 6 hours a day but for 8 or 9 hours a day, which includes athletics or other extracurricular activities, I think can engage boys, and I think that leads to a much more healthy existence. That said, there are fascinating challenges right now, and Lisa may have looked at this for her book, because there are also issues going on right now in terms of shifting brains and brain development because of the ways in which children at an early age start to interact with screens.
Richard Melvoin is the head of Belmont Hill School. Richard Melvoin, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Lisa Bloom, let me come back to you in our final minutes here. One of the things you talk about that we haven't really gotten to yet is that the economy itself has been particularly tough for boys and men in a way that maybe it hasn't been for girls and women. Why?
Because boys are not graduating from college at the same rate that girls are, and when they do, they have poorer grades and poorer skills. Young men in America are unemployed at the same rate as young men are in Arab Spring countries. That is 18% to 25%. It is the highest rate of young male unemployment since we've kept these statistics. You know, we have the stereotype of the 24-year-old man who's lying on his parents' couch. He's a slacker. He's a moocher. You know, it's a very cruel stereotype. I actually found when I interviewed young men, that men who were in that situation were desperate for work and were very saddened about their inability to launch into adulthood. They had no idea what it meant to not go to college in America in the 21st century, how many doors would be closed to them as a result. That's why in the book I'm such an advocate for getting your son that college degree. Many parents give up on their sons early and say, well, he's not college material. I'm trying to push back on that and say, if your son can finish high school, he can finish college. 60% of new jobs in America require a college degree, and so we've got to get him there, and I show you in the book how to do that. It's just critical to his future.
And one thing you say, too, is that, you know, we have this huge prison population. More than 2 million Americans are incarcerated, which is more than any other country, not just now, but ever. And mm-hmm. I think well over 90% of those people are men.
Yes, 93%. It's appalling, and the number is growing. And another 5 million are under correctional control. And we're the harshest country in the world in terms of how we treat our inmates once they get out. 9 out of 10 will get out. But many of them will never be able to get public housing, for example. They can't get student loans. They are ineligible for food stamps. So we make it very, very difficult for them to get employed. They have to check the box on a job application that they're a convicted felon, if that's true, and pretty much guarantees they're not going to get a job. It's a profoundly difficult life. I'm talking about even for a marijuana possession conviction. So no parent wants that kind of outcome for their sons. New prisons are being built every day waiting to house the next generation of American boys. Well, we as parents should be chilled by that number, and we should be doing everything in our power to prevent it. Literacy is the key to your son's future, doing well in school, raising him with good values. You know, all of that old-fashioned stuff is critically important today, much more important, frankly, than when I was a kid, because young men are in prison today at 4 times the rate of when I was a kid. Well, I don't believe that young men are 4 times worse today. It's just that our laws have changed so much. But there is so much that we as parents can do, and that's why I offered up this book.
Yeah, and when you talk about those solutions, I want to touch on, there's a bunch, so we can't get to all of them, but I want to touch on a couple that I think were very interesting. And one of them was take boys away. So travel with them, let them sort of see the world outside of just their home and just their town and just their friends and just that sort of area that they might already know.
Right. So I'm a big fan of international travel if you can afford it, and it's more affordable than most Americans probably think if you travel at odd times and change planes in the middle of the night, camp, stay in hostels, all of which I've done with my kids. We just came back from a trip to Iceland, which is a fascinating, beautiful country. We've traveled all over the world together. It opens up your mind. It opens up your horizons. You meet people who are different, who do things differently, have a different religion, look different, dress differently. All of that is so important to developing an intellectual curiosity and to developing a sense of humility that we have one way of doing things, but it's not the only way and it's not necessarily the best way. If that's not affordable, you know, there are national historic places in every county in America. I have many of them listed in the book. There are museums in every community, most of which have a free night, one night a week. There's no excuse not to take your kid out of his element. If you live in the city, go to the country. If you live in the country, go to the city to stimulate his mind, to get him thinking. And it's a great family activity to do.
And one final question that's maybe a little bit of a curveball here, but, you know, just as we were talking about how more than 90% of the prison population is male, 97% of the people who are Fortune 500 CEOs are also male.
Yes. Are you suggesting we should lock them up?
Not at all. So the question is, how did we get to a situation where it's true, certainly, as you say, a lot of the people who are stuck at the bottom are male, but a lot of the people who are running the country, whether it's politics or running business, are also male?
We are in the midst of a profound cultural transformation. At the bottom stages, education, employment in people's 20s and 30s, women are doing extremely well. At the very, very top, Fortune 500 CEOs, the U.S. Senate, the U.S. Supreme Court, men still dominate. But I believe that as time goes by and as this generation of high-achieving girls and young women continues to age, all that is going to change, and it is changing. But for parents, of course, we're concerned about boys and young men. We're concerned about getting them basic jobs once they're out of school. You know, that's who my book is geared to.
Yeah, and it'll be very interesting to see what this evolution looks like. We've been talking about about boys, about the challenges they face, and what we can do to help them reach their full potential. And I've been speaking with Lisa Bloom. Her new book is Swagger, 10 Urgent Rules for Raising Boys in an Age of Failing Schools, Mass Joblessness, and Thug Culture. Lisa Bloom, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much. I just want to let your listeners know they can read a free excerpt of the book at lisabloom.com, and I post obsessively on Twitter and Facebook under my name, Lisa Bloom, so I'd love to connect with your listeners there.
Thanks. Thank you very much.
Thanks so much. Have a great day.
And Callie Crossley is in the studio now. Hey, Callie, what's coming up next?
Well, you've been talking about how to steer boys in the right direction. We're going to continue that thread with a look at spiritual guidance. When Harvard minister and theologian Peter Gomes died last year, he left big shoes to fill. We'll talk with the scholar and Reverend Jonathan Walton, who was recently appointed to take his place.
It sounds really interesting. I will be listening. I'm Kara Miller.
I'm Callie Crossley, and you're listening to Boston Public Radio on WGBH.